This week, we talk about perspectives. How do we quantify a life of abundance, psychological richness, happiness, creating? What makes a life good? We'll follow that up with a piece that explores Nietzsche's concept of eternal recurrence through the lens of an HBO phenomenon called True Detectives. All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode number 620. I want to thank our contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners of the WCY podcast. Without you, we can't make this show possible. I want to thank everybody who has recently decided to assist us in some way that allows us to continue to offer Masonic education that is trusted to all those interested in the royal art. In the news, I want to give a big shout out to Worshipful Brother Adam Rigdon, who was recently installed as the new Worshipful Master of Watoma Lodge number 148. I know the brothers of that lodge in that district and in that grand jurisdiction are in for a real treat in having Brother Rigdon in this elevated position within our beloved fraternity. A reminder, I'll be doing a Feast of St. John the Evangelist on December 19th in Chicago, Illinois. Details are on our website, wcypodcast.com. And if you're interested in having an educational event where I can come out and do a presentation or even do an online presentation for you all, simply head on over to the website, wcypodcast.com, click on Presentation Schedule, scroll through, you can check out the different presentations I've got, but at the bottom it says, drop me a line and we'll get it scheduled. And you can just fill that out and check it out. So, all that out of the way, let's get into the education this week, the whole reason for this show. I wanted to read first, as tangential to Masonry, a modern scientific topic within psychology. So much of Freemasonry is based around the idea of perspectives and being able to walk in your brother's shoes for some length of time, or if you can't, maybe just imagine it. And so through these ideas of perspectives, people grow as humans, and one of the things that we often talk about in Masonry is making good men better. How do we do that? And really, it is through the lessons we're taught in Masonry that we employ in our everyday lives that allow us to become better. And in this, there is certainly room for the discovery and study of not just the seven liberal arts and sciences, but all of the liberal arts and sciences. And so within that vein, I wanted to read this piece that came from sciencenews.org. This was published a few years ago, September 1st, 2021, by Sujata Gupta. And this was a really interesting article. It's called Perspective-Changing Experiences, Good or Bad, Can Lead to Richer Lives. Even people facing tough times can achieve a good life. And I read this off the cuff of Stoicism, where that particular path leads to happiness through a set of parameters. But it also leads you to living a very rich life in always being aware of what you have and focusing on those elements of our life that we can control and how we make them better in that way. So this, again, is about perspective. And this is an important topic this time of year for so many people for so many reasons. So let's get into it right now. In December, my husband, our 5-year-old daughter, and I tested positive for COVID-19. Life already off kilter, lurched. Smell, taste, breath, were they normal? The air smelled only of cold. Everything tasted vaguely of cardboard. The state mailed us a pulse oximeter to read oxygen levels from our fingers. The device beeped when those levels dipped too low, a seemingly objective measure during a subjective time. We used the device with abandon, only my husband regularly triggering the alarm. He went to bed, where he stayed for days, or maybe it was weeks. Time distilled into moments, remote school, meals, Christmas, pulse ox, beep. We exited quarantine on January 1st, the day of fresh starts, except my once energetic 8-year-old son, who somehow never tested positive, now loafed in front of the heater for hours. My husband, his breathing still abnormal and his fatigue lingering, raged. Ever the extrovert, I absorbed their emotions as my own. My risk calculation shifted as despair overshadowed the fear of disease. The sickness we had hid from for so long had found us anyway. Were we now immune? Should we proceed just as before? Prior to the sickness, I'd been researching pandemic fatigue, a term used to describe the boredom that can arise during a protracted crisis like the one we're in now, at the time of writing, February 15th, 2021, last updated. People prefer action to inaction, social psychologist Aaron Westgate of the University of Florida in Gainesville told me. For some, that compulsion toward the experimental runs deep. She and colleagues reported in 2014 in Science. When the researchers gave college students a choice between sitting idly in a quiet room or pushing a button to receive an electric shock, a startling number went for the shock. I have been seeking and pushing that button all my life. I've taught English in Japan, worked as a national park ranger, and, following an unfortunate series of events, sold pineapples along a tourist highway in Hawaii in exchange for a tent over my head. Westgate's recent work suggests that button-pushing sorts often flourish in rich and aesthetic environs. I took heed. Against the dreary backdrop of being homebound in a global health crisis, I signed up for private pottery lessons. Drawn viscerally to the idea of creating something from mud. A third path. Psychologists who study well-being or human flourishing have long posited that the good life can be pursued via two paths, happiness or meaning. Quote, so far psychologists worked with this dichotomy, a dichotomous model of well-being about life, end quote, says psychologist Shinjiro Oishi. He describes the happy life as one of joy, comfort, and security, and the meaningful life as one of significance, purpose, and coherence, or order. Happiness and meaning can run parallel or intersect, Oishi says. Both concepts are largely rooted in personal and societal stability. What happens, though, when the ground beneath one's feet buckles? Or what if one was never quite stable to begin with? What hope is there for finding a path to the good life? For the last 6 years, Oishi and his team at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville have been hammering out their response. A third path to the good life coined psychological richness. Their research suggests that the ingredients of a rich life come not from stability in life circumstances or in temperament. Rather, the path to a rich life arises from novelty seeking, curiosity, and moments that shift one's view of the world. Rich experiences are neither inherently good nor bad. They may be intentional or accidental, joyous or traumatic. The pandemic in this light embodies a novel, perspective-changing, psychologically rich moment. It has shattered our routines and livelihoods, robbed us of our loved ones, and plunged many into despondency. But it has also steered some of us to the mud. We have captured wild yeast for sourdough breads, planted gardens and knitted sweaters. We've stared at a wet mound of clay on a wheel and wondered, what next? This third good life path can provide a balm in difficult times, says Westgate, Oishi's former graduate student. Quote, psychological richness opens up an avenue to the good life for people whom circumstances may seem to have cut off paths to happiness and meaning, end quote. Aristotle's legacy. If you want to understand psychological richness, read about Oliver Sacks, advises Lorraine Besser, a philosopher at Middlebury College in Vermont and Oishi's collaborator. She is thinking of An Adieu to the World that Sacks wrote in the New York Times in February of 2015, shortly after learning he was dying of cancer. The renowned author and neurologist drew up his inspiration from philosopher David Hume, who had written a similar adieu in 1776. Hume described himself as possessing a mild disposition. Sacks wrote, here I depart from Hume. While I have enjoyed loving relationships, than friendships, and have no real enmities. I cannot say, nor would anyone who knows me say, that I am a man of mild dispositions. On the contrary, I am a man of vehement disposition, with violent enthusiasms and extreme immoderation in all of my passions. Ancient discussions of the good life do not appear to consider Sax's model. Instead, 4th century BC Greek philosopher Aristotle looms large in this esoteric space. He opens his treatise, Nicomachean Ethics, by reviewing the various contenders for the good life: pleasure, honor, wealth, health, or eminence, eventually arriving at eudaimonia, essentially human flourishing. The eudaimonic person, or eudaimonic person, Aristotle wrote, is active in accordance with complete virtue, not for some unspecified period, but throughout a complete life. Of those contenders, only pleasure and eudaimonia, the feeling good and being good, sides of that dichotomous coin, have withstood the long test of time, Westgate says. Aristotle, an unequivocal be-gooder, considered the good life an objective ideal. So does Susan Wolfe. Some philosophers, including me, quote, say a good life isn't just good from the inside, end quote, says Wolfe, a moral philosopher at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Instead, a life must also be good from the outside, or from the perspective of one's community. But the emergence of positive psychology several decades ago shifted attention from the collective to the individual. Now, Westgate says, quote, whether or not it's a good life is really in the eyes of the person who led that life, end quote. Sax's vision. Sax's early years were marked by heartache, according to a documentary of his life that aired on PBS in April. Born in 1933 in London, Sax was sent to a boarding school during World War II, where the other children bullied him and his older brother Michael. In that environment, Michael became psychotic and was diagnosed with schizophrenia. The family was devastated. Then, when Sax was 18, his parents discovered that he was gay. His mother, with whom he shared a close bond, called him an abomination. Quote, her words haunted me for much of my life, and played a major part in inhibiting and injecting with guilt my sense of my own sexuality, Sax said. Sax fled to San Francisco on his 27th birthday and interned at a medical center. Off hours, Sax muscled up, eventually lifting a 600-pound bar from a squat to set a California weightlifting record. He also got hooked on amphetamines, thereby sleeping and eating little, while roaring high and fast on his motorcycle. Sax, the documentary suggests, was running from his own overwhelming loneliness. Quote, that kind of sensitivity is dangerous. It requires a degree of appetite, vitality, and a responsiveness, which means that you could go off the rails at any moment, end quote, the documentary's director, Rick Burns, tells me. Quote, the question becomes, what is the relationship you're going to have to your own appetites, end quote. On New Year's Eve, 1965, Sax stared into the abyss of his drug addiction. Quote, I looked at my emaciated face, and I said, Oliver, you will not see another New Year's Day unless you get help, Sax recalled in the documentary. 6 months later, Sax began seeing migraine patients at a clinic in New York City. During what would turn out to be his last amphetamine high, Sax read a 500-page book on the theory behind migraines, with detailed case studies written by a physician, Edward Living, in the 1870s. Quote, I read through the whole book in a state of ecstasy, Sax said. With the amphetamines in me, sometimes it seemed to me that the neurological heavens opened and that the migraine was shining like a constellation in the sky. After that vision, Sax began writing detailed accounts of his patients' experiences, a process that merged his intellectual and creative passions. Embarking on this psychologically rich literary journey would sustain Sax throughout his life. Beyond the dichotomy. In fall of 2015, Westgate was a graduate student in Oishi's lab. With lab members squeezed into his tiny office for a meeting, Westgate recalls Oishi walked in and asked, is happiness and meaning all there is? That meeting and the ensuing discussion marked a turning point for Oishi. He had, like most well-being researchers, been publishing papers that worked within the happiness-meaning dichotomy. Yet he had grown disillusioned by those paths' shortcomings. For instance, why, as research has consistently shown, did happiness hinge on having considerably more money than is strictly necessary? And why did homogeneous friend circles give people more happiness and satisfaction in their lives than diverse circles? After that meeting, Westgate recalls the team homed in on one question. If you lack money and stability, can you still have a good life? The team looked for a third path, one filled with rich, aesthetic experiences. First, the group developed a scale to measure psychological richness. The scale mirrored those used to measure happiness and meaning. Respondents ranked 17 statements from 1 for strongly disagree to 7 for strongly agree. Statements include, on my deathbed, I am likely to say, I had an interesting life, and my life would make a good novel or movie. The results appearing in June 2019 in the Journal of Research and Personality showed that scoring high in a personality trait known as openness to experience predicted high richness scores, but not necessarily happiness or meaning. Later research revealed that people high in richness are also emotionally intense, prone to experiencing strong positive and negative emotions. People high in meaning and happiness, meanwhile, experience positive emotions more strongly than negative emotions. To see how the three paths, happiness, meaning, and richness, play out across life, the team evaluated obituaries appearing in the summer of 2016 in the New York Times, the Singapore-based Straits Times, and a local Charlottesville newspaper. Research assistants were tasked with describing obituaries using just 12 adjectives, such as secure and comfortable for happiness, fulfilling and sense of purpose for meaning, and dramatic and eventful for psychological richness. Obituaries that scored high in psychological richness also scored high in meaning, but not happiness. The research appearing online, August 12th in Psychological Review, found that major life events such as divorce, career changes, and personal tragedies linked to higher richness but not meaning or happiness. Still, Oishi and his team needed to answer the obvious. Could such an intense, unpredictable, and frequently unhappy life really be a path people desired? The researchers asked more than 3,100 people across 9 countries, the United States, Japan, South Korea, India, Singapore, Norway, Portugal, Germany, and Angola, to score 15 terms similar to those in the obituary studied on how closely the terms described their ideal lives, on a scale from 1, not at all, to 7, very much. A 9-term subset of the 15 terms showed that for most countries, people's ideal life was most characterized by happiness and least characterized by richness. The researchers reported June 2020 in Effective Science. Nonetheless, average richness ratings ranged from 3.7 to 5.62, suggesting that people desired some richness in their lives. Given that ambiguity, the researchers then forced participants to choose which life they desired most, happy, meaningful, or rich. 50 to 70% of respondents chose terms reflecting happiness and 14 to 36% chose meaning as their ideal life. Percentages varied by country but sizable minority. 7 to 17% chose a psychologically rich life. When the researchers asked 1,611 people in the United States and 680 people in South Korea if their lives would have been happier, more meaningful, or psychologically richer if they could undo their greatest regret in life, roughly 28% of Americans and 35% of South Koreans reported that their lives would have been psychologically richer with a do-over. Quote, "That suggests to me that maybe implicit in a lot of people's desires is psychological richness. I wish I had taken on that opportunity," end quote, Oishi says. Puzzle assembly not necessary. Not everyone, however, accepts the shift from a good life dichotomy to a good life triad. There's a bundle of conversations to be had about these conceptually tethered concepts, says developmental psychologist Anthony Burrow of Cornell University. Because for some people, isn't it possible that a psychologically rich life is a life of purpose, is a life of meaning? The critique is valid. As the obituary study showed, richness and its link to major, often negative life events appears distinct from happiness. But those negative life experiences can foster meaning. A large body of literature shows, for instance, that natural disasters and other traumatic events can trigger a phenomenon known as post-traumatic growth, a transformation that gives people a newfound appreciation for life and a desire to help others. An experiment from several years ago illustrates how this transformation plays out. Before richness was in consideration, behavioral economist Kathleen Vohs of University of Minnesota in Minneapolis sought to understand meaning and happiness in isolation, which was tricky because happy people also tend to lead lives high in meaning and vice versa. The researchers identified only those variables linked to happiness, such as satisfying one's needs and wants, or only meaning, such as spending time with one's children. Their findings, appearing in 2013 in the Journal of Positive Psychology, revealed that happiness in isolation is linked to a focus on the present, while meaning in isolation connects the past, present, and future, often through self-reflection. The distinction between meaning and richness, as such, hinges on whether stitching together the strands of one's life, or coherence, is essential to building a good life. People who study meaning say yes. Oishi says no. Turning to fiction to make his point, in Muriel Barbery's 2006 novel, The Elegance of the Hedgehog, and Rabi Almadine's 2014 Unnecessary Woman, the main characters are poor and lonely women who are neither interested in making the world a better place nor feel that their experiences add up to some greater whole. Instead, the two women, Renee and Aaliyah, pursue lives filled with consuming literature, art, and music, Oishi says. Quote, both women appreciate moments of ineffable beauty, Proustian moments of elongated time and aesthetics, and lead a life full of inner richness, he and colleagues wrote in 2019. Oishi's proposition is simple, yet radical. Experiences, whether mostly vicarious, as with Renee and Aaliyah, or firsthand, can offer a good life without summing up to anything greater than their parts. Quote, ideally, we want to have all three, happiness, meaning, and psychological richness, end quote, Oishi told me in an email. But having just one is sufficient to lead a good life. The creative impulse. After the neurological heavens opened, Sachs published his own book on migraines in 1970. He followed it with Awakenings in 1973, documenting the miraculous recovery and relapse of catatonic patients who began to clap, walk, and talk after treatment with a medication for Parkinson's disease, before fading back into unresponsiveness. Despite his lifelong intellectual and creative frenzy, Sachs remained ever alone. After a brief fling at age 40, he was celibate for the next 35 years. Quote, he was not happy, he was creative, he was productive, and he was moving forward, end quote, Burns says. And I think if one is creative, productive, and moving forward, one is moving toward happiness. Though Burns uses the term creative casually, the pursuit of art seems uniquely suited to those seeking or forced into a rich life. People who score high in openness to experience tend to lead more creative lives, says Oisin Vartanian, a cognitive neuroscientist at the University of Toronto. And Oishi's work has shown that aesthetic experiences increase richness. For instance, in a 2020 study in the European Journal of Personality, Oishi and colleagues compared richness levels between students studying abroad and students who remained on campus. Though both groups started at the same richness levels, richness scores among the students studying abroad went up after 12 weeks. Student diaries revealed that the study abroad students participated in considerably more artistic activities, such as going to museums and concerts, than students who remained on campus. Engagement with art, Oishi says, explained partially why the study abroad group had higher psychological richness. As COVID-19 variants ricochet around the globe, a great many people are now like those students studying abroad, not traveling but dosed in a different kind of richness. Here in this foreign terrain, we too seek beauty. Scientists have largely focused on the artistic genius, the prototypic creative, Bertanian says, but the pandemic suggests that we should also study and encourage the everyday creative. Bertanian counts himself among this everyday lot, During the pandemic shutdown, someone gave him a broken play structure for his children. D'Artagnan couldn't access the parts he needed to fix it, so he learned how to chisel and do woodwork to get the apparatus in working order. "Doing things I'd never done before," D'Artagnan says, "was so greatly satisfying for me. I recognize the feeling. When I entered the pottery studio, I knew nothing of the craft. Simply centering the clay on the wheel took me 7 lessons. While I can now center small lumps of clay with relative ease, beautiful forms elude me. A half year on, I have thrown misshapen bowls, a smattering of wobbly cups, and precarious vases that fold at the neck. I am at my own life's midpoint, awash in imperfect vessels. Completing the triad." In the Venn diagram of the good life, Sack spent much of his time outside all 3 circles. By midlife, though, psychological richness had become his beacon. Yet, in crafting his patients' stories, Sack made his life about something larger than himself, Burns says. He turned the mirror around and said, "I'm going to look outward in order to also look inward." Sack had landed at the overlap between richness and meaning. Then, in his late 70s, Sack fell asleep, madly in love. After a lifetime of struggle, he finally felt he belonged, not just in literary or academic circles, but within himself. In that adieu, Sacks remarked, "My predominant feeling is one of gratitude. I have loved and been loved, I have been given much, and I have given something in return. I have read and traveled and thought and written." Gratitude, research shows, is the language of happiness. At the sunset of his life, then, Sacks had arrived at the junction of those 3 paths. He nailed the ending, Burns says. That's given to very, very few of us. Well, I hope you liked this article. What I found very interesting about it was that it was so easy to correlate these different elements to things that we do within the fraternity, or at least opportunities that we're given within the craft to explore these different elements. It's a very interesting thing to consider when studies and articles come out like this, that without any sort of effort, one can connect so much of this to what we do within the fraternity. It's just amazing. But it's kind of a testament to a Mason's general attitudes. I often post the episodes of this show on Facebook in groups, and I preface it with a link to the show saying, "For those who live a Masonic life." And what is that? Certainly, I think it's a life that expounds on this sort of triad. It maybe even goes a little farther. Next up, I want to read a piece called "No Escape: Nietzsche's Concept of Eternal Recurrence." This was published on May 1st, 2023. Many of you have spoke with me about Nietzsche or have listened to my lectures on Nietzsche and Freemasonry and these kinds of things. And if you enjoy those, then I think you'll enjoy this article as well. Now, the article makes interesting correlations between one of HBO's famous crime dramas, True Detectives, but let's see where this goes. This comes from the Masonic Philosophical Society, Recapturing the Spirit of the Renaissance. Let's check it out. "No Escape: Nietzsche's Concept of Eternal Recurrence" by MPS writer Joe. In HBO's landmark 2014 crime drama True Detectives, 2 troubled detectives find themselves on the trial of a serial killer, seemingly more interested in metaphysics than mere gratification. Like all good cop dramas, the pair are polar opposites, as much at war with each other as the killer they hunt. Rust Cole, played by Matthew McConaughey, is a jaded nihilistic lone wolf. After the death of his daughter, he resigned himself from free will and self-determination. "We are things that labor under the illusion of having a self," he intones. He is Arthur Schopenhauer with a southern twang. Woody Harrelson's Marty, on the other hand, has no time for pessimistic morass of Cole's soliloquies, preferring to spend his nights away from his wife and kids drinking, fighting, and philandering. As this odd couple tightens their grip on the killer's henchmen, they find themselves in a shoot-em-up at a compound deep in the Louisiana swamps. After battling their way inside, Marty discovers 2 kidnapped and abused children. He murders their kidnapper without a second thought. In a flash forward, Cole reflects on the case. "Time is a flat circle," he remarks. "Everything we've ever done or will do over and over and over again. And that little boy and girl, they're going to be in that room again and again and again forever. Drenched in the fiery petrol of Nietzsche's philosophy, Cole directly references the concept of eternal recurrence. In the penultimate section of The Gay Science, Nietzsche asks us to consider a thought experiment. What if one night a demon crept into your room and said to you that all your life, all its pain and joys were to be repeated innumerable times? Would you not throw yourself down and gnash your teeth and curse the demon who spoke thus? Or have you once experienced a tremendous moment when you would have answered him, "You are a god, and never have I heard anything more divine"? In True Detective, this specter of infinite monotony is pessimism incarnate, for life is a horror show without remorse or salvation. Marty is doomed to be a philanderer, unable to stay his hand, to stay true to which he loves, but forever to fail and give in to his basest desires. Cole, meanwhile, is destined to live a life alone, no escape. Whatever momentary happiness he found in the normalcy of his wife and daughter will inexorably turn to ash in his mouth. To Nietzsche, however, such an interpretation is a perversion. Unlike Cole, the German philosopher did not see man as an automaton. We are not programmed, nor are we a tragic misstep, as Cole would have us believe. Rather, eternal recurrence causes us to pause and ask if we truly act with purpose. Would we be so callous or flippant with our time if we were destined to find ourselves here again? Eternal recurrence is life's affirming, not denying. Continuing in The Gay Science, we find one of Nietzsche's most profound quotes. Quote, "I want to learn more and more, to see as beautiful what is necessary in things. Then I shall be one of those who make things beautiful. Amor fati, love of fate. Let that be my love henceforth. I do not want to wage war against what is ugly. I do not want to accuse. I do not even want to accuse those who accuse. Looking away shall be my only negation, and all in all. And, on the whole, someday I wish to be only a yes-sayer." End quote. The key line here is to see, quote, "what is necessary in things," end quote, that life's good moments only come after we've journeyed through the bad. And that pessimism is as much a choice as looking away. After all, to become to escape one's pessimism is Nietzsche's great hope. In fact, in his next book, Thus Spoke Zarathustra, the act of becoming is transmuted to all of humanity. Man is something to be overcome, to herald the Übermensch, the higher man. The last man, in contrast, is he who cannot affirm earthly existence, who refuses to be overcome, and who dwells on life suppressing norms and otherworldly illusions. In the final moments of True Detective, the two detectives, now irrevocably bonded, share a short dialogue. Rust Cole, "We didn't get them all." Marty Hart, "Yeah, and we ain't gonna get them all. That ain't what kind of world it is. But we got ours." Rust Cole, "I'm not supposed to be here." Marty Hart, "Yeah, well, I'll come back by tomorrow, buddy." Rust Cole, "Why?" "Don't ever change, man." But Cole has changed. His final line, "Once there was only dark. If you ask me, the light's winning," suggests a true change of heart, a refutation of pessimism. How do we reconcile these two aspects, not to change and yet to become something more? Nietzsche once again holds the answer. "Become who you are," he implores. In a task of Sisyphean heroism, we must become who we are, destined to be, and to love our fate. And if we don't manage it, well, there's always tomorrow, buddy. I really like this post. It's quite poetic in that it does really do a wonderful job of tying these two things together. Oftentimes, Nietzsche is so difficult to read for a lot of folks, and it takes quite a number of readings to really grasp at what he's trying to say. And of course, this is not only due to the language in which he speaks, but it's also an issue with German to English and concepts and ideas having to be translated into more than single words as they might be in its original language and all of these kinds of items. But this particular piece was great just because I really enjoyed the focus that the author gives to perhaps one of the greatest lessons Nietzsche gives us. And he talks about giving in to the idea of the higher man which in some way is a sort of surrendering to the future, understanding that things will get better, things will change, you are not going to be the best. You know, Nietzsche says something like, and thus spoke Zarathustra, yea, think you are the ebb of humanity. Well, you know, the ebb, you know, is this the farthest the tide of evolutionary existence pulls into the land? No, it isn't. And this is foolish to think so. And he goes on to speak of the last man. And this is a great tragedy. The last man is the man who thinks that they are godly, that they are not from earth, that they are from on high, who understands all things and who looks down on other people and gives into these sort of otherworldly illusions. This is sort of a knock on organized religion of his day. Nietzsche, of course, had a large problem with organized religion and the church of his day due to the overabundant paradox of what the church says and what their actions are, both in public and behind closed doors. And this ties back to Masonry in that we should always be looking to better ourselves, to never be content with the way we are, to continue to work, and to be wanting and excited for the new, to pave a road, to make the world a better place, to make it a habitable place for what surely is to come of the human species at some point, the make-waying for the overman, which is to say, not a capped-out level of man, but certainly one that is better than what we are today. That's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed this deep dive on the psychological subjects of change and bettering of life and witnessing the good things through perspectives which change our lives for the better. I hope to talk to you all next week. I want to thank one more time our producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners of the WZY podcast. Want to support the show? Awesome. Go to the website, click on Support the Show, and check out the various options. Thanks in advance for considering, and until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
WCY Media.
Next, the is not.